So we ended on a note that we, on beneficial ownership, unless we hear otherwise, we are broadly, as I find, identifying with Peter's summary. Right, so let's hear from the public stakeholders one last stab at it before your negotiations. What is it you're unhappy with, if anything at all, still?
So it's FTE share on page 8 of the bill, section 5, that we have concerns. But if people will, if guidance are given in terms of the then I just
can't hear you. So even the acoustics are very bad. Can you bring it closer?
Okay.
On this side we can't hear.
Okay. It's on page 8.
Yeah.
Subsection 5.
Yeah.
Where it says that in A, that if we are unable to identify the natural person, we have to establish the identity of each natural person who otherwise exercises control. But Peter had also alluded to the fact that guidance could be issued to clarify that, and if there's guidance, then we could address it in that matter.
So you are fine.
What did you say?
Yes, on the proviso that there would be guidance.
All right, so I'll leave you with that. I'm sure that we have been able to have good. It's this is quite a complex area. I also, when I read this bill, I got very worried. Interestingly, I anticipated some of the issues that the public stakeholders have raised. But I think those ones should bear too much in the other direction as well. That we can understand where they are, but ultimately the national interest, not the interest of the industry, that must play. Right. Not to be taken into account. And I'm sure some of you in your public capacity, and the role you play, say certain things, but privately to your partners and your children, you might well agree with us, you know.
So thanks for it. So yes, this is one of those national interest issues, and this is really an issue around us going beyond the set of recommendations. And as I tried to explain, it's largely around the domestic private sector, prominent, influential persons. And there are ways we can deal with it, and as I was saying, we sort of appreciate the concern around the lack of a list. For the politically exposed persons, no issues there, because there are international lists which the industry has always used. Even though we caution against using a tick box approach, we do understand that the lists do help in terms of the due diligence process. For the private sector, we unfortunately don't have a list. I think government is working on something. So this will be people who undertake business with government. So as there is a need of provision, we have said it would be an entity which engages with government for a tenor of a certain value. We haven't specified the value. We said the minister will prescribe that. So either way, we have tried to limit it, but the challenge coming from the industry is that they still wouldn't know who exactly is doing business with government. So there is a process to try and, I think, come up with that tender list, and I think Raymond will come in. We would still prefer, for the sake of national interest, having the provision in, but suspending explicitly its effective date. And this will be just on the domestic private sector prominent influential persons. For the rest, it should be okay in terms of application. Raymond?
Just without even stretching the issue further, where Polar is taking it, we're looking at the fact that at the moment Treasury is working around the e-portal that would enable publication of all tenders awarded, you know, beyond a certain threshold. So by allowing more time for the implementation of this aspect, then enables us to then deal with that aspect to make sure that the systems work as well as we want them to, so that as we start gating in the implementation, we are certain that it is a private sector and can have access to a more reliable information that they can use for the purpose of identifying who's doing business with government. So that's what informs our hope that at some point we can be able at least to implement this aspect. And I hope that they find that at least reasonable for now.
What are other issues that arise, which means we have to look at the text you've got, right? I don't know. I'm just asking members to. This term politically exposed, doesn't it make, is there some text there that politicians are somehow more likely to do wrong things?
Yeah.
I'm surprised cabinet is to process this like this, right? Because I accept that politicians world over, it's going to make South Africa, have enormous power. Enormous capacity for patronage and nepotism, enormous ability to benefit their friends, allies, family, and so on. That's true by the nature, nothing to do with this country. Somehow, you know, the way it appears in the media, like, you know, we are terrible. Nobody asks who benefited from the oil deals in Iraq, right? Nobody asks. Dick Cheney was vice president of the United States at the time. Where did he come from? Which companies benefited from the oil deals, if not those who largely supported the Republican Party, right? And the George Bush, who funded the campaign? You see, my problem isn't when people point to corruption of public representatives. My problem is in a racialized society like ours, there's a sub-exodus that some people are inherently, biologically, and genetically more predisposed to corruption than others are. I'm not saying you say that, David Minion, though people contribute to that. Right? I tell a journalist, hey, you do good work in exposing corruption where it's bad and it's genuine. Although you often get it wrong, and once a person's there, you Google him, even if he's found innocent, right? In the Google there for generations to come, you were accused of this and so on. And the press never points to saying that, you know what? The subtext, you see, the average racialized internal person says, yeah, I see certain people. Black people, African people in particular, nearly feel corrupt. So nobody will say, yeah. No? What happened in the oil deals in Iraq? Who benefits and so on? Those are white people, right? So all people are capable of corruption. And politicians in general are vulnerable and susceptible, but also quite capable of doing wrong things. But is this term, in a country like ours, not maybe having a racial subtext. I don't know, I'm just asking it. Struck me on Tuesday night. What's that interesting? Monday night. It's a question. Right. And around the there is other issues. So, this word comes from the FATF, right? When they say politically exposed, are they trying to imply that public representatives are more likely to be corrupt, or is exposed in the sense that you're more likely to be abused by the private sector? And do we need the PEP at all in our context? Why can't we have the same concept with a different word? Then there are other issues I don't fully understand. You see, you're dealing mainly, from what I can see, with the issue of the private sector. How will they get all these prominent, influential persons, right? But in the public sector, you're saying fine as you have it, right? Now, for example, would a local government councillor not be teased off if you are wanting to look into his, especially if you have multiple partners and so on, cultures and customs allow it in this country, and it's constitutional, not that it matters if your culture and custom requires it, you will do it in most societies, whatever the constitution says. All issues around that, is the scope not too wide? Is it doable? Sometimes if you have something so light, it's good in principle and moral terms. But in practice, because it's so wide, nothing gets done. So you might as well seek sometimes to do 5 things and achieve 3, then seek to do 10 things and achieve 1. So all these things enter my head. But I have no views. On the other hand, what we are clear about is an emerging democracy with huge inequalities. It's probably true to say, I don't know, with the social inequalities we have and historical legacy we have, but maybe politicians here are more vulnerable. Right? So we need to find a balance. necessarily other deviates from the aim. But in the use of terms and so on, and in some of the innuendos and connotations in the society of racialized that ours at the state, I need to be slightly careful. So those are some of the issues that I wanted to raise. What do you, Margot?
All I wanted to say was that I was also, I mean, when they presented the, you know, the choice of words of this and this, and I was saying to myself, why can't it just settle for it? Because they cover everyone without having to elevate the other as if the other is, you know, is inherently or is most likely to be corrupt or something like that, you know? And I think maybe the question, that's my view. I think we should try to for the next one, which is deep, because it includes all prominent influential individuals.
Yeah, I like that.
I feel that way too, but I want to hear the argument. I agree with you. Anybody else want to say anything? Yeah, give it.
Two questions or three questions. Clarification. Why in your definition of domestic prominence in influential person, which is crafted clearly for the domestic context, because it deviates from the sort of internationally accepted definition, did you not include leaders of trade unions who in the South African context wield enormous political power? That's on a declining scale. That's the first question. The second question, they're either not prominent or not influential according to the Treasury or votes. Have a look. But I do think, I would have an appetite to amend the clause to include trade union leaders, but I'm interested in why they're not there. It's a very obvious omission. In respect of the privateness, I absolutely understand in this context why you included that clause. And I also understand industry's difficulties that they would need act off a state database. But given our procurement system, I don't think it would be too difficult to compile. I would have a lot of reservation about not implementing some kind of deadline, because it would give the executive space simply never to produce the database. This is integral. This is what I call the Gupta clause. The last question is just from a background which the industry might want to reply to or not. You said earlier that there are established lists which institutions use to determine if it's a PEP. I'd be quite interested in who produces those lists and how they're compiled. It sounds rather murky to me.
That's a proper take that first round of questions. Then we... So, Chair, we agree with you on nearly all the points. Because those are exactly the issues we grapple with. I think the first point then to make is we have done away with the title political exposed person. So you won't see that title in the bill. What you would see in the bill is prominent influential person. And that was very much trying to deal with the sensitivity around singling out certain persons. Secondly, it's only fair to say that if indeed they're going to be a corrupt person, then arguably there is a corrupt in the process. And hence the consideration that we might actually have to include the private sector side. Of course, it does widen the scope, and this is where we end up with the issues around can this be practically enforceable. We get the sense it might, if there are certain instruments in place, for now it might just be a bit difficult, and hence we're talking around how best we can phase in that requirement. But arguably it's something we might consider keeping in the bill and phase it through once we've got the necessary measure. And one of those is the list which Raymond has also touched on. Why not union leaders? I think I'll leave that to Raymond and Peter to answer. On the deadline, I take the point too that and Peter did caution against the deadline. I think there is an element of trust. So probably one way of dealing with it is to see if, as government, we can impose some kind of deadline to come up with those various instruments. But bearing in mind Peter's caution around deadlines.
Deadlines in some cases
are useful.
In other cases, we've got to take it case by case basis. Although I'm not sure whether we need deadline for this, but maybe we do. But I'm just saying, don't say because we said no deadline for that therefore it doesn't apply here. I don't know. I don't feel strongly either, but we can apply on it. Raymond, you want to come in?
Thanks, unfortunately, you don't let me the difficult one to deal with. Maybe just in context, the concept itself of political spokesperson is naturally linked also to those who have access to public resources, for instance, you know, taxpayers' money. Well, let me not even, you know, say natural. I think the idea behind it is to say that those who have the opportunity to take advantage of the public resources, so it's targeted at those. And I think for us, for having left that part on union leaders, more than anything, it could be an oversight on our part in trying to figure out why then would, you know, union leaders have access to public resources, either because they, you know, they are active politically, therefore they have access to public resources, or either because they have businesses and that is like could be captured within the category to the private sector business people who do business with government. But I think something we can get shared, we are not averse to consider in that sense.
Presumably your generic definition covers NGOs, anybody who has access to resources. Is that right? So powerful NGOs also for them?
Not necessarily NGOs. I think
only trade unions are not NGOs. I'm just trying to find out where does it begin in the definition.
There's also an element of that to be practical in terms of implementation, because the longer the list and the more difficult also it becomes for the institutions to be able to apply. And if we are not able to apply, then the effectiveness of the legislation then is weakened.
It's a good discussion. Could you give sort of an NGO which you believe wields political power? I'm
until very recently, Fangoko was there, right? It's a national federal structure. And in certain different periods, the TAC has been very powerful and so on. I would imagine land will become a big issue in the next few years. And, you know, you can't legislate simply on the current situation. You're also going to anticipate that. So I would imagine NGOs in the land area will become very strong over the next few years. So they will be strong. I'm asking because, you see, when you're talking about trade unions, what a good question. Where do we begin and end? I personally, let me put something to you. Right? If you look at business unionism in this country, even the majority party in Kosovo itself have been complaining about what is going on there, right? If you look at the Kosovo's, it's all in the public domain, Kosovo's pension fund stocks, right? If you look at Kosovo's report itself complaining, they are openly admitting to all these challenges, right? Now, when we're talking about trade unions, we're not only talking about Kosovo, we're talking about trade unions in general. And I certainly think that they do have a lot of resources. And they themselves are saying there's been abuse of those resources. But I don't know where you begin and where you end. I know when a certain person will say it, that rightly so other people see targeting one trade union federation, targeting one community and so on. And that may or may not be the situation. But the parliament will also have to apply online to be consistent. Trade unions have huge resources. If you take the efforts of NUMSA, they come and say, focus on NUMSA because you're from Kusatu. I'll just give you an example. Or you take the efforts of NUN, turning into billions, I think, right? So what I'm asking is, what is the criteria that we use, and where do we begin and end? I'm not saying it applies to trade unions. I'm just saying by throwing these examples out and reminding people, and I'm also urging people, I am very close to Kosovo, obviously. I play another role apart from the role I play here. But I'm saying that if you lie in the public domain, as Parliament, we need to apply our mind to it and be clear about why we say no to trade unions or why we say yes to trade unions. I'm just doing my job to be safe, right? Makosi had hand up. Particularly, you have spoken. You speak, Makosi. Tandi had hand up.
Yeah.
On this issue, yeah. Okay, Tandi, particularly Makosi, David.
Chair, I want to ask a question that relates to what is stated here as a prominent influential person. Once you say a prominent person is influential, then it is inherent. So, in my opinion, it's not inherent. It's not inherent that prominent people are influential or influential people are prominent. You might have influential people who are pulling the strings from behind, who are not prominent. So once you limit the definition to prominence, it means you only target those who are in the public discourse, but no, it means the list will be compiled on the basis of their prominence, not on the basis of their influence. So it's not inherent that influential people are prominent. And if we dispel this notion, it will also allow us not to look at prominence in a sense of looking at politicians, but it will also cover the scope of those who are influential across the board in society. Mm. So it will cover church leaders, business people, union leaders, everybody else who is playing an influential but not necessarily limited to influential. I mean prominent. Influential but not limited to prominent. Because there are people who are very, very influential but they're not prominent. They're not known actually. They're actually the ones who are pulling the scene behind the scenes. They actually, the ones who actually make certain actions to be taken without necessarily being prominent. So I would urge that we reconsider the words. We can say prominent and all influential people. I think in the legal context, it covers a problem if you say prominent and all influential, because then we would know that that's limited to prominent people, but you also have a those who are influential. In an event that you are taking time in the court of law to provide proof whether a person is prominent or influential in this context. Thanks.
Chair, though I'm reluctantly agreeing to the proposal by Honorable David, specifically on the inclusion of union leaders, but I would like to propose that why do we have to look at the union leaders or other than looking at the sector? Because I'm asking myself, predominantly when you look at the main union leaders, when you classify them, then we are getting to a certain corner where we are all avoiding to go. There are those other leaders. If we say a sector, it will also include those leaders of the association, but they are in the sector of labor. I wonder if I'm clear. So when you talk, yeah. So I don't want us to go to that corner that we want to. Don't want to go all of us. So instead of saying non-leaders, let's say labor, but also I want to agree with you in terms of the NGO. Why do we have to be selective? Anybody like Honorable Tandi has said, anybody who think can be influential needs to be included, but not undermining the advance, like the more we add, the more problematic it will be to implement the
I'm not saying that I am persuaded by Tandi. I think we need to say prominent or influential. I think it makes more sense if you say so, because a person may be not prominent to you, but in his own circle, he is prominent, right, because he's influential. So it's important that we don't leave something that's going to be so ambiguous at a point that you can end up complicating what we are trying to achieve here. But the other thing that I am very cautious of, Chair, is that you see, once you start naming people like this here, to me, honestly, and you will have to forgive me, Chairperson, it kind of, like, look like some kind of covert racism, if you know what I mean. You are not necessarily saying, you know, black or whatever, but in the way it's coming across here, it suggests it. And therefore, I think Candy is correct. If she is saying, let's rather say prominent or influential person in society without necessarily having to be unpacking all that. The other complication that I'm also worried about, I mean, just if I'm spoken this much here, but you know, once you start putting the duration of that the person must have been in a particular position for X amount of time, we know people who are even were actually acting as president for only people who are the candidate of presidency. No, I'm just saying, but that's a fact. I'm saying, it doesn't, you don't necessarily need 6 months, okay? You don't. It is bad that you're not. So I'm saying maybe as much as possible, and lawyers like you must help us, you know, try not to be too ambiguous, try to bring this thing together so that it's not subjected to so much manipulation. And you know, I mean, we are actually, these people will be winning cases left, right, and center, just on grounds, on technical grounds, you know what I mean? And this is why we need not, sometimes it's better to say less than to say more. Because another person who may not fall under this category may say, I'm not listed here. I may be a member of an ordinary member of parliament, and I can be maybe, we get recalled all the time, I can be appointed as a minister yesterday, and in that short time, I mean, for 10 days, I'm just about 10 days, for 10 days, I can do a lot of things, you know what I mean? So I'm saying, let's try and avoid becoming too specific. That's my concern.
You know, my first argument about a test, and the test that I used in including trade unions in my formulation was, of course, a broad test of, you know, political influence and political power and access to political power, but I'd equipped that subjective test. So I do think we should apply our minds to whether there is some object test, which, of course, raises the question, what test did the National Treasury use in drafting or in compiling this definition, which is obviously very carefully thought through? Was an objective test used, or and how was this list derived? I think that's the first point. But the second point, I also have reservations about including a constitutional court judge or any other judge. My question would be, is that consistent or inconsistent with the internationally accepted definition of test? In other words, are judges of the High Court included in that definition? I have a reservation about that. And then my question about the murky lists of PEPs, that was not answered.
We are all saying, mind.
example, people are pointing out you can be prominent and not international, vice versa. I think that's correct. But I mean, there's an international set of terms you use, and as far as possible, you stick to them. So you can still retain the acronym, but you can say and or. Right? So when you define it. Then the second thing you might want to think about is, on the one hand, you don't want to have a long list, and you want to be generic. But on the other hand, you have to be really specific, otherwise it's fine in the sky, it's not a law, because it's too general. And then courts will decide, whereas it's parliament. We've been through this before, by the way. It's interesting, you know, Gary, it's the same cycle of issues, you know, when you look at a village. In 1998, when I first came here as a chair, we had the municipal structure stuff. Very similar issues, right? The politicians are constantly preoccupied with this. How generic and how specific? How temporal and how long term? So I think if you listen to what people are saying, I think you get carefully at the more sensible things. David is saying also, and what the end is saying, it's always sensible. Then you can see that bigger gap, which for you to pull it together and give us a text. So we accept that domestic and influential and permanent, but you can retain the term. The test, as the question I often ask, what norm do you use and how it's similar or different from the national norm? Thirdly, we agree that insofar as it's possible, and it should be swept to the fullest extent to avoid any racial subtext, but on the other hand, that is out of the fact that by doing so, we're not going to let any person of any color, either whatever, Indian color or whatever, escape. So we can find those balances. I think everything people have said, it's a combination of you, but mainly him, because you represent Parliament, and him, the policy person, working with Peter Paul, who pulled something together with him, to cover all these issues. So I'm very worried that our parliamentary support staff are not coming in more. You've been especially quiet. You can also do this on the ones here. But you obviously know you can speak at any time. They don't see you as six people. You've been very quiet. So basically, you get the gist of what I'm saying. That's all the things people say in different ways, most of it carries value. And you can find compromises. But we also need to hear after you've spoken from the public stakeholders.
Maybe I'll just respond in general without going too specific of the question. But I think the best point to make, the Honourable Member has made a very good point in terms of acknowledging the fact that, you know, people could be, or a person could be influential without being prominent. And I think that without hesitation is something that is worth looking into, that we can say a prominent and or influential person to be able to, you know, cover and not leave any hole in that regard. Yes, most definitely. Most definitely. Now, in terms of criteria, the international standard itself, it's specific. Although it does not prescribe that dosha, but it gives specific examples of what should or may be considered prominent and politically exposed person, and it has that particular list from head of state and so forth and so on. But another issue also to consider is that the standards themselves are aligned to the fact that each and every country may adapt to the standards to their basic circumstances. For instance, depending on what you may consider in your specific jurisdiction, or depending on the scale and extent of corruption that one could deal with in your jurisdiction, then you have the flexibility to determine the length of the list of those you want to include. You may want to make it shorter, you may want to make it longer, but they are not really very specific and prescriptive of, you know, the particular positions or levels that you must into, but they do use those specific terms like head of state and also the charges, as the Honourable Member has indicated. That also is included in the international standard that members of the judiciary at the highest level and include the military and so forth, they are also included in that particular list. So that's what in our, you know, process of doing this we took into account. But the most important thing was linked to the fact that, you know, there has to be, to some extent, a link to access to public resources as a reasonable criteria. Thank you. Yes.
international standard. And if so, what have you got here that's in addition to what the guideline? How do you think the guideline?
The concept public reasons. I wanted to know if church resources are also classified as public resources. You know, I am asking that. I was thinking about what has been happening in Rome over the years, you know.
I think the way everyone is using the word or the phrase public resources relates more to the discuss and tax revenue.
But then, how would it apply to the state regulations? I mean, not changing the whole, you know, the
system. Because then, you don't have any rights to monitor, say, a union or an individual unless they're getting money from the fisheries. What does the MPSA say? It must be public resources.
The fiscal, as I indicated earlier, that Article 21 helps us to limit the length of the lease, such that we can't do the work.
It rules out all this. You must intervene action and say, look, colleague, would you respect it? Even I'm here, okay? You can tell me in generation, you're wasting our time. You can do that, you still have. I think you want to step us and look, I don't care about the decorum and parliament, I'm the decorum, right? There's no rule that if the chairperson is wasting the time, and the members are able to get upset, you tell the chairperson, this is absolutely irrelevant today because public resources mean exactly this, taking it. Why do you think children should be in charge? They think children should be in charge. Stand your ground and say, no, you leave that on. So why are you involved in it? You have the right. No. I can tell you we have a DDP here. I think, of course, you will know. If we tell the DDP, can you remove the code? He doesn't say. He will spend 10 minutes defending the common. And you know, when he left, you know what I'm talking about, a former UDF activist, you know, he thinks out to the when he left, you can imagine that he has been stuck, sorry, that committee, Colin Eaton was here, a wonderful Colin Eaton. When he left, you know how we missed him. Because the next DPD came, and without thinking, and then we were having some villains come very late, and she was the chairperson of the mayor, said, hey, what's that comma to me? Just let's move the comma. And I point out to the DP, no, that comma is correct. Never mind what the members should explain to my morning. So can you please stand your ground because you would like your mind to the thing. We had a whole debate, but we could have avoided. So public resources, is that the criteria? If that's the criteria, am I right to say you can't apply to the church, you can't apply to the trade union?
Can
we apply to the court? That's an interesting one. The court does get its money from the public business, yes. Even so, where does the money come from? Other countries, they do not have it. when they're putting judges in, they're not expecting that in every country. If a minister is fighting and the judge has no say, then that can't be the criteria. But it's here, I think there's something in between. There's a new law that was passed where the Chief Justice, they fought for, I think since Samuel Maduro was here, yes, and they finally got it when Jeff became the Minister of Justice. So I think that judges should apply for the reason that Makoshi says they essentially, but they says, and they do have some latitude over the money. And so the reason you're saying, I think it should be good.
Chair, I constantly I think the scripture is to discuss the objects of the amendments that we want to make in the legislation. I'm not sure if we go into details about discussing the list, we'll be dealing with the definitions on the basis of the objects of the list. I don't know whether you can make those. The point I'm trying to make is that we're trying to provide for based on the object of the business. This whole research part. So when we definition, we shouldn't be too far from the object of the business. Because we might run a sort of wanting to define guidelines and policy interests and how it should be. Do I make sense?
Yeah, it's a definition. And a definition has to be provided. Because in the body of the law, there's no explanation of what the term means. So I think we're not saying things, they're not going to be used. They're consistent with my question, you and they're the same, actually. So what I'm saying is that the issue that they have put in a definition of such, and questions are being raised whether we should have the deal or not. My sense is that the majority are probably saying we should have, for the reason that they do have some power over public resources, so why they should be exempt. And two, vertically up till now, unlike India and other developing countries, less developed countries, what's any US costing that or all that, those people are very susceptible. And our judges too, who look down in Zimbabwe, they're not speaking. And for all those reasons, having judges should be included.
Yeah, Chair, I'm raising an issue of principle, not the issue of the truth. So I'm not discussing whether we should include the judges or not. I'm talking to the principle method itself. Unless if we say that there is the definition, it's limited to the names of or the conditions that have been in research here. If it's limited to, then it becomes a challenge. Can we get that achieved from
now? No,
no,
no.
You
see, it happens in other fields, right? Where what you do is you have a definition. Sometimes lawyers, even some of the lawyers, before you move the pipeline, sometimes they say, in a definition, you have to be precise. You cannot be the minister and may add to the list in a definition. But if you have it in the body of the bill, you can say, this is what applies. And the minister may regulate additional entities falling under them. So that every time you discover a new entity that you want to include, you don't have to come to Parliament to pass a new law. You can even say the regulation must be tabled in Parliament so the committee can see, they've added two new entities, these two new entities are consistent with the other thing that we're doing, the original act, etc. So it's lawyers who's guided. I see what you're saying. She's correct. Ideally, if I had my own way, I would do what I'm saying, which is, but can you do that, Advocate James, and say the definition set out in 1G may be expanded by the minister after consultation and table in Parliament. But I think that again, your thesis is going to come to that when it comes to a definition. We can only do it in the body of the law. I don't know what the new thinking is. Okay, let's hear from them. If you want, and then you come in.
Okay, sure.
Can we do that?
Okay, I think the technique from a drafting perspective to do that is to study the definition. The definition includes everything as mentioned in a schedule to the Act, and you give the minister the authority to amend that schedule from time to time. That's exactly what the FIC Act has done with the scope of institutions that are subject to the provisions of the FIC Act. It doesn't define banks anything like that. It says if anything is included in Schedule 1, the minister may from time to time amend that schedule. So it gives the flexibility for that list of whatever the list is in the schedule.
Chairperson, I would agree with that. There's no specific rule to say you cannot draft a definition like that, but the way it is done is to say prominent or eminent expired person is a person first in the schedule or in the section. And there one can say this is the list of people or as described.
Yes.
And then one gives the power to the minister to make the delegation.
I prefer this for elegance and simplicity, rather than having a schedule. Are you okay with that, Peter?
I think that's fine, Mr. Chair. I think that the only reason why I mentioned schedule later on when it's implemented, it's easy for the manager in his proclamation notice or his regulation notice to say, I mean, schedule done so by doing the adding that. It's just a...
Mr. Jenkins, you're fine with that. Okay, so that's what we're going to do, right? And do not mean losing all of these things as well, right?
Good. Okay, so what happens if you have some prominent kids with
text? I should throw my
leg. Rather than look at the text now, because there's going to be all these changes, you will look at the text when you get into these pieces. But you're then going to lose weight to the business. I'll take it for
sure. So, Chair, this is the one area where we need to continue engagement with the industry. So in that sense, the concern from the public or industry is that we are talking about moving toward a risk-based approach, which is essentially a sort of principles-based approach, while we also load the bill with a lot of rules. So this is what's coming from the industry. We have said, yes, we're still going towards the risk-based approach. However, we do feel that we need at least minimum standards or basic rules of compliance. And given the fact that the federal standards also prescribe minimum standards. So it's not necessarily unusual to find a legal instrument which actually contains both principles and rules. And as I indicated, the sense is that we should move towards more of a principles or risk-based approach. So I think the debate now is how far we can go in terms of including rules in the legislation. And as I said, we see them as minimum standards. So that's essentially the issue on risk-based change. I've covered it correctly.
Yeah, there's quite a few things you'll have to work around, right? Is that correct? So you can't really spell out to us right now. It means discussion and negotiation.
Yes.
Alright. Now, what I want to suggest is that, we can give you the mandate, but that's not something we can discuss here. Right? So we think to you, we agree with you that you have set minimum standards, and you work out the permutation between risk base and rules. Now, on these five issues, have any of the public stakeholders any comment to make before we draw to a close on this issue, and then they will try to help us with additional issues that were not covered by this time. Now, the DA raises the prospective line. Did you get answer to that? I don't recall. I think that's an issue. So you'll come in on that one. So can we have on these five the other tables? What are your comments here on any of them? Yeah.
So, Jay, on the safe approach, we would really like to engage with the National Treasury in terms of how we understand the first in the box and maybe get clarity in terms of, because we agree with the intention, but the way the bill is written, we understand it.
Rules, and that's just where we need to just have the discussion.
Alright, any other of the public stakeholders?
Anybody wants to comment? Mrs. Yamani is not here, she's gone. Anybody else have a comment? No. All right, in that case, let's go to your one and do a signing to add the others.
Trying to get that, say,
what are the scores, because it does not come quite clear from the institutions what courses are they referring to. I mean, the institutions should have been able to comment on that. But also the social implications, which is something that we're looking to understand, and which we'll comment subsequently. I think we've got a report from Centenary. So those are the issues that we've got a lot. Thanks.
One or two other issues that strike me, listening to the son. You know, this thing about the cost of this thing. He's right, it came up in November, right? Because the cost ultimately, you know, it is the free market economy. Who will be born, not the banks. It's the client of the banks, the consumers. So you put all these things, and they're all good and we support it. But the consequences are, in a time of enormous economic stringency, we are putting consumers out there. That's the one thing that's worrying me. The second thing is, there were some issues raised yesterday. I don't know where they fall into the... I just, unfortunately, didn't save my documents. Something has fallen away. But Makoshi raised this thing of linking supposed to the international financial flows. Yeah, so where does that come in? I don't know what I got, the compliance for this guy, I forgot what the issue was there. Yeah, this counter money laundering advisory council, right? The way you answer that question is, well, we're not doing very much in it. And what you've got is more effective, is that correct? And nobody who was in the counter money laundering advisory council, I'm starting to see the question I want to quickly answer. Is excluded, or either excluded and they weren't really doing much anyway. But then you've got an agreement that you need CASA and you'll need the Lawyers Association, right? So on the issue of traditional leaders, coming back to definition, right? Presumably that's something over and above what the, you know, the FATF requires you to have. I don't think it's there in the national internet of standards, is it? Is it there? Okay. I don't think it excludes traditional leaders, because they are funded by the purse, right? So, see, I think then that case falls. Once you explain the criteria, it's anybody who has access to public resources, right? Right. Then, because I think traditional leaders are going to be up in arms, right? But once again, we're focusing on arms, blah, blah, blah. Now, when you consulted on this bill, did you get the National House of Tradition to just look at the bill? Did they comment? Because all bills, I think, that affect the House of Tradition is, as I remember it, of course, was it only local government legislation? No. It affects the National House, or tradition must be seen by the National House. If that is the case, that's correct, that's what it takes. Any bill that affects traditional leaders must be given to the National House of Tradition to look at.
Traditional law or customs traditional communities. Not necessarily the National House of Traditional Leaders, but if it affects the customs of traditional communities or traditional law, it's quite specific on that. So a lot of the legislation that is passed affects everybody in the country, but it's specific on those areas, then the bill must be sent there.
For active consultation by the executive. We Parliament sent it by the Senate, that's the issue. But was it any obligation on them to send the bill to the National House, like all local government bills have to go to them, that affect on everything local government affected in some form or not? Would this provision apply in this case?
Would we make the amendments to the question? Because as the bill was introduced, we didn't send it, we didn't find it necessary to send it.
The question really is, do you think we should just send it to the National House to look at it?
There's never a problem with extensive consultation.
That's
not an obligation.
All right, I don't know whether members want to send it to them, but they can get quite patient. And they really use it as a thing, and then some of them not to take part in the local. Would it be a crime if the executive just sent it to them?
Yes.
You don't want to do it all again.
Thank you.
compare DPI bills where it affects them, it doesn't affect the tag. Because it's not about customer distribution. It's not about their powers and functions. It's about accounts, which like a PMMA, which also affects distribution of leaders because they're using some funds, is that right? Yeah. So that's sort of example. Yeah.
No, you said
you were right. I think you were right when you were saying, you know, traditional leaders can get very, especially in methods like this. And you know that we had a serious problem, issues of accountability, especially in as far as the state funding is concerned. There's always been, that has always been a contested terrain. And now, if you are mentioning something like this, they may actually blow it up and say, you know, we're never consulted, and yet we are mentioned here, we are even told, blah, blah, blah. And here, the other thing that you have to also understand, I mean, being from Barcelona, and this is my champagne, still have to ask. See, there were you say a member of a royal family. I'm saying, I'm not saying some of the things we do that for tactical, not on teachers. You know, you don't do them because it directly affects them, but maybe you do them to. So when it gets past, you don't have it, you know.
Jewish delegation, traditional aside. Okay, you were not here yesterday when one of the ladies of the list, they said, yeah, these kings rule very keenly. You come to the cathedral, right? Mm-hmm. No other person can do it. It's to come itself, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just kind of provoked the thing, and I wonder who's brave enough to say these things, not worry about the economy. I don't know if you just know our superstitions. I think let's do this, I'm going to send it to them. The office of the community have a look. And if they want to come to make representations, they can come to
Chair, so there's something interesting in the bill itself. So section 7.10 says, the state law advisors are of the opinion that it is not necessary to refer this bill to the National House of Traditional Leaders in terms of section blah, 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 since it does not contain provisions.
Obviously, for those of you who don't know the chair and others here, we're just being facetious. It's a long day and we're about to go to a close and you can't be all the seers. So what we're basically saying is a courtesy service to them. It does not affect customer tradition. We are going on what you say, Lord, what you said. It's about... So basically what we're saying is just go to them and come back. So on process issues, can you respond very quickly to the issues that you have just said? We have just raised with you. And then we need to go to a close. It's 12 minutes left.
So just quickly, I'll just pick the question. So on the
customer... Mr. Lee, we discussed your issue in absence, right? You are very badly represented by a colleague. That's your problem, right?
Chair, I just wanted to insert a question. So are you suggesting that the National Treasury or the Executive Service would go to the traditional leader and say, we get to send
them? Because then they can explain why they got it all and so on. And then we would say to them that they are welcome to come forward. Now, they caused a problem in the first instance. They got a courtesy sentence to me. And Minister Nene comes from a certain province. He should have been more sensitive. And it comes from a certain area of a certain province, even more so. Now let's be more serious. So quite quickly, listening to what you're saying, and moving on.
Chair, so on the question around the council, as we indicated yesterday, there seems to have been some misunderstanding of how the council was supposed to work. Chair, we have agreed that we can easily incorporate some kind of consultation we can have it, and I think that will deal with the issue. I think it's largely around when FIC issues directives, if those can at least be consulted with the public. So I think that will be our tentative response, Chair. So let me pass the others to Raymond and FIC also.
Thank you, Chair. I'll just deal with the issue of core implications, and maybe my colleague will deal with the one on financial flows. In our socio-economic impact assessment, we do acknowledge the fact that there is a possibility of cost implications, but at the initial stage of the implementation of the risk-based approach. But then going forward, our view is that that would be mitigated by the risk-based approach implementation in the sense that institutions will only be dispensing resources only in those areas that are considered to be higher risk. Exactly. That is our view. As we also... More definitely. Hence, we link this... That one, yes. Hence, we are linking the risk-based approach also to financial inclusion, because we believe there's a bigger scope to benefit from the implementation, if it's done locally, which we have no doubt. Working together with the industry, it will definitely be that provide that.
I'm not convinced about financial inclusion. Can you come on? Can you tell us in what sense? It's like, using a politically correct term, you see, there was a time when a certain president was into African Renaissance. Every other member of parliament used that term. Every official came. If you doesn't want to be event, I don't want to. There was a term called super information highway. None of us are to it. And we all use that term, not me. But let me tell you, that was very, very attractive. Yeah, very, very advice, actually. You know what? You actually see in 1996 what the ICT world is going through, the fourth industrial revolution. That was really, actually, very advanced for that business at the time. Okay? So I think that's very remarkable. People can say what they want, but in 1996, they were presenting very amazing things. And everybody started using this term of the super information highway, not that we understood what it was. Okay? But now, hey, that was very advanced, right? For the time. So in short, can you tell us, not to show us in what sense on Monday, Tuesday, mission, that's one of the first items to respond, tell us what financial inclusion really we care about. Right? And we want to know what sense does it really have. The next thing very quickly is, can you just try it because we've got 6 minutes left, yeah.
I think Peter might want to cover some stuff.
Yeah. Thank you, very quickly. I think on the issue of recognizing the relevance of this financial flows. I'm not sure if this is done expressly in the legislation, but it definitely has a link in providing transparency to the financial system, which is the first to illicit financial flows. So I think that in that sense, this is one of the tools in our toolbox to deal with the issue of the illicit financial flows.
Okay, 65% is through BET, 30%, of course, is money laundering, 5% corruption. So 30% or so is through this sort of stuff that you're tackling here. All right. In our report, maybe we can add that this is yet another part of dealing with IFS. Do you want to say something
about that? Yes, Chair, just a reminder, we'll be meeting with the industry next week. So it's just a follow-up on what you had suggested in terms of having someone from Parliament being
asked. I don't want to detail the other members. What I'm suggesting in broad terms is that we sit now for 5-10 minutes, the entire team, and we work out in a much more structured way, the number of hours we got next week, what is doable between now and Tuesday. So when you come here on Tuesday, you deal with issues that you've already secured consultation with stakeholders on. So we're not going to go mechanically through line by line. We're going to say, on CASA, you finished that matter, law, well, that came out yet, right? On the bench thing, or what pitch thing. So I don't think any members want to sit here and welcome to come. We should put the formal meeting, give us 10 minutes, those who want to come and join us, where we discuss process issues, and so we manage expeditions in the speed. In the meanwhile, can I thank people, those who want to say good day, for your tolerance over the last 2 days. I know some of you are very irritated with me at times, which I understand about pushing things when really we should be getting text. But I do think, won't you agree, Olana, be careful how you answer, that we did add some value by giving you direction, so that when you discuss, you're not acting in a vacuum.
Yeah, I agree. The guidance has been...
I hope the members here want to agree with us. You and I, we know, we found this.
It's on the functional relationship with a small one person.